connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Network. Networking software.
World Wide Web for the web.
Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Hello and welcome to NetSurfer Pro, whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web. I am your confessor this week, Galen.
And I am, of course, here to listen to your confession.
Oh yeah, sorry. Right, that's not the proper intro. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been...
One week
since you let me confess my sins.
I know, I have a once per week limit.
Yeah. I have a lot more sins I could confess. Let's see, what did I do this week? I did do a little bit of lying. I did cheat at my second grade math exam.
Aren't you in high school?
I'm actually in college.
Oh, wait, were you giving the exam or were you taking it?
I was creating the exam.
Oh, okay, but you cheated at creating it. Did you use ChatGPT again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, that's inexcusable. Banished to 70 years in hell.
Ah, damn. Okay. Well, thanks. I'll say a couple Hail Marys now. That'll do me any good. Oh, shit. Wait, hang on. I'm just looking now at my pocket watch. It says I need to look at my normal watch. Okay, let me just check my phone. Holy crap, 7:59. I need to go to NetSurfer Pro right now. Let me just get in my car. Duck, duck, duck. Doop. Vroom. Screech. Dunk. Doot, doot, doot. Okay,
I know you're still in the booth. I know you're still in the confessional. You can't fool me.
Damn it, I can't fool God.
You're lucky I haven't found my button that opens my trap door to hell.
Oh man, I am really lucky, especially because I stole that. By the way, I'd really like to confess for stealing. I've stolen so much. I've stolen the show so often. The show of NetSurfer Pro, Whirlwind Ride Through the World Wide Web, which I do with my co-host Matthew Marissa.
And I'm the co-host. I've been sitting outside waiting for this to get done with.
Oh yeah, don't worry, this will just one more minute. Oh, so Lust, that's also a really big one that I do a lot.
Look, I think people have gotten the lust thing a bit confused. There's good lust and bad lust.
Oh, so it's like an alignment chart of lust.
No, it's just how your lust... You know what? You can go because I don't want to explain this right now. I'll let you off the hook for all the other things. I just don't feel like explaining the lust thing right now.
Still in heaven, baby. All right. Yeah, I'll say a couple Hail Marys and get back to you next week. Oh, man. Sorry, it's really cramped in there.
Are you ready to record now?
Yeah.
Now that you've gotten your affairs settled?
Yeah, I guess we'll step out of this confessional booth and just into the sound booth.
Yeah, they are right next to each other.
It's a really efficient church.
Mm-hmm. It's a church and recording studio because podcasts are all the rage nowadays.
Yep, yeah. Thank God our local pastor has his own podcast, The NetSurfer Pray, a whirlwind ride through the worldwide...
gospel?
Yeah. but, you know, now we can borrow it for our own show.
Yes. And so if you're hearing some odd sounds, it's probably because we are in a church?
Yeah.
I'm going to edit in some church bells? Good. Those were church bells, all right.
Okay, well, let's see if we can drown it out by talking about some dumb shit.
Yeah.
I'm already swearing in a church again. I can confess it next week.
Before we get to our main topic, I just want to briefly talk about something, which is that I have started reading for the first time, and I have been reading Hunter Hunter with an X between them. I don't know if you're supposed to pronounce the X or not. Is the X silent?
I'm not sure, but I do just want to inform you, I am not actually a priest. This isn't confessional, just so you're aware.
You were the one confessing.
Well, yeah. You know, I'm just making sure you know. Like, you don't have to talk about your sins right now.
So, Hunter x Hunter, it's funny because, like, my brother told me a while ago, like, he tried reading it and he didn't think it was good. And he said that I wouldn't like it. And normally I trust my brother's judgment on these types of things because he knows my tastes and whatnot. But like, well, for one thing, one friend of mine, we made a blood oath that if he started reading One Piece, I would start reading Hunter x Hunter. And he started reading One Piece. So like, I have to commit to that.
Nice.
But also, there is the new fighting game coming out, Nen Impact, which is being developed by Aiding. And Aiding only makes good games, and so I feel like I wanted to kind of learn who the characters were before playing the fighting game, and it was worth it. I think Hunter x Hunter is really cool. I don't want to explain a whole lot because I don't want to get super into it. It's not the point of the episode, but it has a really interesting mix of typical shonen, like power versus powers, but also there is a lot of focus put onto like the mental and mind game, to the point where there are a lot of battles that either don't have to do with attacking, or the concept of what an attack is so far removed from what you would expect. Like a game of tag where one guy just lays down like the tortoise on the grass, even though he's the one who has to tag the other person, just to like fuck with the opponent.
I don't want to be guy who has only seen one anime in his lifetime.
If you say it's like JoJo's, then that's fine.
Yeah, I will say the idea of, you know, strange power sets, but more than that, battles that are revolving around not even attacks or powers, just mind games and the ways that those things interact, has a lot of JoJo's vibes.
Yeah, they're not really as avant-garde as the JoJo's powers. Like, you're not going to get the fucking Zipper Man in Hunter x Hunter. But you do get some really interesting abilities, which I am always a fan of weird and unique abilities. My favorite character, though, doesn't really have any special powers. It's Leorio, who, like, hasn't appeared in the past two arcs that I've read. It sucks because he's a great guy. He's a med student. He just doesn't appear as much.
I made the reference to Phoenix Wright upon seeing him in the fighting game.
Mm-hmm. He does seem to have an objection super move, so like that's helpful.
It is really nice that his power seemingly is just kind of like vague aura punching.
Mm-hmm.
Like I do appreciate the sort of normal guy, but just kind of can punch with a superpower skill set.
Yeah.
I mean, that's basically Jotaro is what I'm describing. So, yeah, it looks interesting. The fighting game certainly looks interesting. I do think, that was a weird way to pronounce interesting, but we'll move on. I do think I will be playing it if you end up getting it.
I will
it.
Force you to play it, yes. Yeah,
because, like, I've already wanted to pick up Marvel before, despite being not the biggest Marvel or Capcom fan, because I think it's a very interesting, you know, 3v3 fighters are cool looking, and upon rewiring my brain to think of it more like Pokemon, where you're choosing a team that covers each other's weaknesses, I kind of clicked with it. So, yeah, I don't really know if I have much interest in Hunter, but I'm very happy that you picked up a new and interesting thing that has a whole lot of stuff you can catch up with.
Currently, I think I'm near the end of the Chimera Ant arc. Those guys are fucked up and weird. I love the weird designs of, like, the early Chimera Ants, and then they become humans, and then they have the cat boy and, you know, the rest.
Hell yeah.
But characters are great. Does Killua is gay? That's my question. It's a good series. I enjoy it. And the Greed Island arc is pretty great. Also, this is in the list of anime where people play serious rock, paper, scissors.
Nice.
Alongside Kaiji, No Game, No Life, and, of course, the best one, Ultimate John Ken, a.k.a. Ultimate Rock, Paper, Scissors.
If I were to rank that, I would go Ultimate Rock, Paper, Scissors, Kaiji, Hunter Cross Hunter, Whale Poop, No Game, No Life.
Yep, mm-hmm. That's the exact spot it deserves to be in.
So, hey, now that, you know, while we are in a church...
Yeah, I like this. I've inserted myself between the segues.
Yeah.
Making it much harder to segue, even though we had a great tee to hit the ball from.
Like parentheses in closing a segment.
Yeah, or an X between two words.
We are talking about a topic we've already discussed about.
I know, surprise.
This is a part two. You may want to watch the part one. More realistically, you'll want to watch the series we're going to talk about. This is about Verde, because two very interesting things have come out about it. Number one is episode 3. The first episode we did was over episode 1 and 2. But number 2, which we will get to after the episode, is supplementary documents.
I actually would like to talk about the documents first.
Ah, I see. We have a conflict of interest. Maybe we should do rock, paper, scissors about it.
But if I do rock, he'll be expecting that, so they'll choose scissors.
Good old rock. Nothing beats it.
Oh, right, I forgot. The Simpsons is also in the list of anime where people play serious rock, paper, scissors.
Okay, so Simpsons, then Ultimate Rock, Paper, Scissors. Alright, so yeah, Via Verde, really wonderful series to catch you up really quickly. It was a web horror web horror, web series at the very least, that takes place in a video game called Green Valley, or Via Verde in Spanish. It is a fictional video game that was being developed with a experimental TH brain device that literally directly connects you to the PlayStation, and unfortunately, things messed up, like they tend to do.
Mm-hmm.
So what we currently have is the game itself, which was an Animal Crossing-style video game of, you know, living in a town with a bunch of cool little characters, but real people are trapped within this sort of, this strange scape, and them being trapped there has seemingly warped the surrounding landscape. The one thing that is consistently amazing about this series is the fictional video games and even real life video game references that has been like animated all custom, obviously, by the creator of the series, Alluvium. It's a really wonderful little tone piece because it is very of the period of PS1. There are like minor things that could have been better about it, but overall, so much of this period is represented and is accurately represented. Lovely little series. And I'm very happy that we got another episode and that we've gotten the first supplemental documents.
Yeah. So, there are three YouTube videos that are sort of the main core of the series, but as of whenever this was posted, there are now extra documents added to the series, meaning this is sort of a multimedia experience. This is sort of a step that I think not a ton of web series do, but often adds a lot of substance if done well.
Yes.
I think, like, there have been times where it's felt like the addition of extra material hasn't added a ton. Like, Catastrophe Crow eventually released the full version of the game, quote-unquote, playable on, like, Itch. And I feel like while there was some interesting stuff in that, it didn't feel super, like, substantial or adding much.
It felt to me, personally, and I love to talk with the creator at one point and discuss it in, like, an interview or anything.
And, you know, if you want to come on and talk about,
Petscop.
What's Angel Hair? There we go.
Oh, yeah, Angel Hair, good.
If you want to come on and talk about Angel Hair.
But I'd love to discuss more about it, but to me, it feels like the ARG was failed, quote-unquote. Not like the ARG failed, but the community didn't solve it, and so the consolation prize was basically, hey, here's the materials I used to make the series. But, you know, in a fun, well, in lore way.
There was
some interesting things to find.
Well, yeah, there was, like, the Unity project files, and then there was the playable build. But, like, I think with Via Verde, for one thing, it's not over. Like, Catastrophe Crow is pretty much over. It doesn't seem like there's much else that can happen from it. But also, like, it doesn't seem like there needs to be. Via Verde's got a lot going on, especially with Video 3. But, like, I think the documents are, it's an interesting step. Like, it implies there could be other types of media involved than just the videos that are, like, canon and important. And in this specific instance, they're very important documents, and I'm really excited to talk about them, I guess. And I think why I wanted to talk about them first is because they are very important for the context surrounding Via Verde in-universe.
Yes.
So I also want to bring up a few things, which is that these documents are from the perspective of a, like, case report done by an FBI agent. An FBI agent by the name of Robert Saturn, writing this in 1996 after an investigation to the Shizuoka Institute of Science and Technology, which is sort of the lab that all of the stuff regarding Via Verde is happening.
Yeah, the labs themselves were the ones developing the TH brain device, separate to Green Valley Via Verde, the video game, and Via Verde ended up becoming attached to it as part of the later process. But the TH brain device, the way in which the brain connects to the PlayStation, is sort of the central figure of the documents.
Yeah, well, I would say one of the central figures, but there's one of the features of the documents is it covers a number of major players in, like, the behind the scenes of the TH brain.
Yes, we have actual names for a lot of the major characters now.
So the main figure is Dr. Kunimochi, first name not given, redacted,
yeah,
black boxed. I'm excited for October. That's a spoiler. But Dr. Kunimochi studied what the paper calls the decoding and preservation of mental synaptic languages, which is essentially in the fiction, like turning brainwaves into electronic signals to then be read and stored by computers. I think like this is a pretty standard science fiction and science concept of like the brain has electric signals. So hypothetically, somebody could interface with that using electronics. It is the basis behind so many other sci-fi, like VR or head implant technology, as well as like when people do like synaptic interfacing, like the furries that made Tails work in VR chat.
Yeah.
That's sort of along the ideas involved. This is still obviously a hugely fictionalized version of that to make the story work. But in this case, that study or that like research led to the creation of the TH Brain, which is the system that interfaces with a PlayStation 1, new and state of the art in 1996.
Yeah, the details of which like the TH Brain goes from being this device that's, you know, very prototypical to an interface that connects to the brain is detailed in the documents in a really fun and interesting manner. Primarily, it follows Dr. Kunimochi seeking investors, as any good scientist needs to do. He finds initial investment from a Czech, like, financier, like a money guy.
I mean, just an investor.
Yeah.
Like, a financial investor who seeks out projects, more of a venture capitalist.
Yeah. It sees initial investment from him, and I believe there's a couple of others, but he's like the primary one.
Yeah, the main investor is Georgi D. Kostov, a Bulgarian person who we just mentioned all his sort of accreditations.
Yes.
And there are other investors. It is implied that the game companies that made games for the TH Brain were also investing in the project.
Yes. One of the steps is that Kunimochi ends up sending out prototypes of the TH Brain device to other developers in order to, you know, be like, hey, you can develop with this cool new tech.
Yeah. And I just want to mention that one of the companies that is actually investing in the TH Brain is called Onyxware. Just keep that in mind.
Now, one of the turns that the documents take is Dr. Kunimochi ends up in discussing with Kostov. Kostov is very interested in the ability of the TH Brain device to specifically, like, prolong human life or maybe, you know, give a version of life after death, as all rich people are, of course. And Kunimochi is initially hesitant in the documents it's noted, and like throughout the series or throughout the documents themselves, it's mentioned that Kunimochi is kind of like hesitant and not forthcoming with information initially because of the like dubious moral nature of it. But it also mentions the key piece of the puzzle is that Mr. Kunimochi had a dead daughter in 1898,
mm-hmm.
which is, of course, perfect motivation for any character.
Wait, 1898?
1898, yeah, he's really old.
He's so old then. Like, wait, hold on. 1898, 1996 minus that, that's at least 100.
Yeah, it's 1989.
Okay. Thank God.
Yeah.
Kostov is just very interested in death, and this leads to a really interesting bit about the kids that are at the center of this series. So there are five named kids in the document. Of the five kids involved, we already knew Matthias Crespo. There is also Kazuya Murakami from Japan, Jansung Gvarachkeli from Bulgaria. I probably butchered that last name, I apologize. Oliver O'Reilly from Ireland. Very Irish name.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Chloe Delafoy from France. Now, all of these kids have some sort of illness that is either terminal or like a chronic illness, like something that can't just be cured or fixed.
Yeah.
So some of the ones listed are Kazuya Murakami, who has radiation exposure causing several like odd growths. Chloe Delafoy has lung cancer, and Matthias is deaf and mute.
Kazuya Murakami is the oldest one, yes?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And he has radiation poisoning. and this was around the 1990s, so minus 10 years.
So it's listed that, or it's mentioned that these are inherited, I think. So it's that, like, his mother was exposed to radiation.
Yeah.
While he was in the womb, or...
I'm just now realizing he probably has radiation poisoning because of, like, Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
And that translates to the bombing in the first Vi Verde episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, the part of why this is important, though, is that one of Kostov's, like, conditions was that they have to use the TH brain when somebody dies.
Yeah!
Which is extremely fucked, but that happens. Jansung dies during the, Jansung dies during usage of the TH brain due to, like, an arrhythmia. And it said, like, oh, we looked into his mother's history and found this condition that could have caused the arrhythmia. The possibility that the TH brain caused it is not ruled out, but unlikely.
Yeah. I also like that it notes specifically that while they tried to resuscitate him, they couldn't use a defibrillator because of the TH brain device, because of, messing with the chemicals will fuck up the child.
So here's the thing. To do this, they have a surgical implant in the prefrontal cortex that they have to interface with for this TH brain to work. Part of why is because the TH brain can alter their perception of time.
Yes!
And this is something that always, like, fucks me up inside ever since One Fight from Bleach. But, like, the amount of time the kids perceive is longer than in real life. And so, in order to not cause, like, shock, essentially, when the kids are brought back to the real world, there is, like, a whole disconnecting procedure where the internal clock resynchronizes with real time.
Yeah.
And if the process isn't completed, if it's not properly resynchronized, then the kid could die or go into a coma. You know, bad things can happen with brain shit.
Yeah.
And if also, like, the computer itself will tell them whether or not it's safe to disconnect the child. So while Jansung was dying, the TH brain did not want to disconnect him.
Yeah, like, it's very interesting the way that multiple times it is indicated that there were, you know, procedures for, like, bad or, you know, worst case scenarios, but they failed. That's one of the interesting things about this document I like, is that there is... While it is clearly, you know, morally and dubiously ethical, there was still care in the scientific procedure by the higher-ups. It was just a failure of a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is going to go into things I'm going to say later, but let's continue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's not a whole lot else to go from, like... Jansung is dead. It's revealed that there was a lot of, like, a huge amount of data that was created and stored during his death.
Yeah, it's like 9 minutes after he was pronounced dead, it was still collecting data. And the reason that Dr. Kunimochi gives is that he was, by some pressuring from Kostov, he was developing a, like, system to have, you know, to encode data in case of death.
Yeah.
But it should not have been in the version of the game that they were currently testing. So it's weird, like, while it is the only logical explanation, it's also weird that it happened still. One of the things that I really, really love about this series is that it treats the gravity of the situation really seriously, which other series don't. I've seen series that have not done that. But I feel like it is really well written and fairly realistic in terms of character motivations, because, like, the moment one of the kids dies is apparently when the team comes forward to the Japanese government and is like, hey, we need help.
Yeah.
And this whole investigation starts. Like, it shows that while it was a process of morals getting looser and, you know...
Pressure from outside investors.
Pressure from outside investors, pressure from the doctor's own motivations because of his daughter. It was a slow, you know, corruption of it, but the moment that it crossed a line was when the team was like, oh god, we have to try and solve this and we need outside help.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I like that it is handling it with weight and seriousness, and that ultimately, like, even Dr. Kunimochi is... as the report says, cooperative about this process. Like, I think it is very interesting that we have a company, or not a company, but like a research team that is not the villain.
Yeah.
Seemingly. Like, there were several bad things they've done and very unethical lines they have crossed, but they're not evil corporation.
Yeah.
It feels like a misguided technology.
Yeah, it's a tragedy of technology.
Very pressing themes here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the, you know, the interaction of capital and science to create tragedy.
That's... Especially with generative AI.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a few other things to talk about with this document. It also mentions that since that event, that Kazuya and Oliver have begun generating a lot of data, but so far those two haven't really appeared in the series. The only child we've really seen in the game is Matthias.
Yeah.
Who has also been, you know, generating a ton, as we have seen and will discuss. You can tell sort of what parts are relevant to him. Though it is interesting knowing that there is an Irish kid in Valle Verde as well. I do wonder how much of Irish Catholicism is going to come into play.
I also have to wonder if the Troubles are going to come into play with the Irish kid as well. Because, like, that's one of the other things that I find interesting is a lot of the kids are specifically from very turbulent political times. Mm-hmm. And so it does feel like my grand theorizing here is that we have the information in the documents that a lot of the things that were generated from A, the kids' memories, B, a library of media, which is where we get a lot of the cool and interesting fake games and real games, like a library of media that was meant to kind of inspire and like be there for the kids to generate things with, and C, the game itself kind of playing from those memories. And so my current speculation is that the reason that when all of this happened and when the kids, like, were in their hyperbolic time chamber, kind of having the digital decay of this world, a lot of it was directly inspired by the extremely turbulent political times that all of the children were living through. That's why we see a whole lot of, well, that's the Watsonian reason we see more direct references to Argentina's political climate of the time, is because it's really relevant to Matthias, and it also makes a lot of sense that, like, a young child would probably mix a lot of, like, Catholicism and, you know, the mythology that he knows with those sorts of themes.
I will also say that in those situations, the families would be a lot more struggling for money and medical care.
Yes.
And they'd be more willing to take a deal that is so risky with their kid who is, you know,
yeah,
has some sort of chronic illness or disability.
I don't remember which child it is, but one of the report notes that one of the families just continued to do it because they were struggling financially.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah, really interesting. I feel like there's a lot of really good capital T themes that Alluvium is playing off of with right. the series.
I will say that with Chloe, there are references to the French Revolution, but that's like so behind when the yeah. story takes place. That, like, it is an interesting pick that there are these things specifically related to France and France's history, but I'm not sure if that is, like, how that would fit in with your reading.
Yeah, I would want to, you know, Google more and see if, like, the 1980s and 1990s were also a very big political time for France as well, to really try and solidify my theory, but... Yeah, like, that's my initial reading with this supplementary document, is that a lot of this is born of the kids because they themselves were born into very turbulent and, you know, cruel worlds.
So, I want to take off my digital interactive media extrapolation hat and put on my, formal critic hat.
Yes.
So, I like the way this is written. The tone is very good. Like, I think the tone is very fitting for this type of report. It's, like, dry and serious. I love things that have a, like, follow-the-money sort of storyline.
Yeah.
The fact that this goes into, like, investors and major players is really cool in, like, a conspiracy board sort of way.
Yeah.
But also, it makes sense and it helps develop the story. Like, it's like, oh, there's this weird investor, and then it's like, oh, he's interested in death. oh. And then it's like, oh, these kids, all the, like, I think it does a good job at setting up information that we kind of know where it's going because we're familiar with the rest of the series, but it is also set up for the sake of the person who would be reading this, you know, this report.
It's, yeah, the report has to be written as though the person does not understand what's happening, which makes it good for our purposes as well, because it's really good exposition.
Yeah, there's sort of a dramatic irony to it as well, whereas, like, as it's, like, mentioning the kids that are being researched, it's like, oh no. We know where they're going to end up, and we just are watching the ride.
Yeah.
Another thing is that I think a lot of these web series, when they are involving both a piece of media and the creators of the media, they have a hard time working in the details outside of the media. I'm only thinking of that one Mario 64 series we talked about that, like,
yeah,
had English people working for Nintendo because the story demanded it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they were played a pivotal role in Mario 64 enough to add all these secrets into it. Like, yeah, like, I think
I hate ragging on that series so much, but it is just kind of a really good, simple shorthand example.
It's a good scarecrow to shoot bullets at, you know what I mean? Like, I was also thinking of Shipwreck 64. That kind of makes sense because, like, part of it is that it is, like, trying to hide these dark truths about an evil company. But then there's, like, puzzles and shit in that game where it's like, did you have to do this to put the dark secrets about the evil company? Like, we know there's monsters at Disney World. You didn't have to put a fucking Simon puzzle in there to get to that. But that's beside the point. I think, though, while it's like, you could make the argument that it's, oh, how did Alluvium get these documents? The Alluvium as the character, not the real person, mind you. How did the character of the person finding the stash of Via Verde tapes also get the FBI document that's top secret?
Yeah.
And maybe that will be answered. Who knows? Because Alluvium as a character outside of the, like, outside of Via Verde's videos is a character who does things specific to the story.
Yeah, the first video of the series is the, like, one of him finding the VHS tapes with the statue of Mary, I believe.
Which is shown in Matthias's bedroom.
Yes, yes. We get pictures of Matthias's bedroom, and it's, like, a lot of details are one-to-one with the video game. It's so good.
Yeah. But going back, like, I at least think this is a really cool way to divulge information about the Shizuoka Institute of Science and Technology, which was established in the first video, and then, like, other sort of main players. I think we have gotten some information on both the Institute and the kids in the game, but there just hasn't been a great way to inform us about, like, you know, why some of these things happened, or, like, the fact that a kid died during it, maybe that's something you could have picked up on, or maybe that was hinted, but also, this is just a very straightforward way of delivering that information.
Yeah.
But, like, I think, like, the fact that it is, that Alluvium is taking a separation of, like, these are things that are allowed to be told in-game, and these are things that are only allowed to be told out-of-game, is very wise, and as far as this document goes, is executed well.
Yes. Speaking of things that are executed well...
Oh, god damn it! Why did you have to do that as your segue?
I know.
Okay, so Via Verde 3 is incredible. I know that goes without saying, the other two were also incredible.
Yeah.
But this one's incredible.
It's, if you're listening to this and didn't really feel like going and reading the extracurricular material, that's fine, I get it. But this is definitely another case of, hey, maybe go watch the episode and or watch the whole series if you haven't. Because, oh my god, 3 is so good and dense.
So, I feel like the first scene in 3 is sort of a last time on Via Verde, because it doesn't do a whole lot for the story of Via Verde, but it's sort of a reminder of some of the characters and their positions within the game.
Yeah.
As well as just world building of what the game would have been like. Because we start with the player character entering the science lab of Dr. Neato, which is a fun way of spelling Neato. It's like N-E-E-T-O-W.
Yeah.
I do know that is a name you can have as well. And, like, you know, it could be a name. I wonder if there are any characters named after, like, team members at the lab.
Yeah.
Or if it's something to do with Onyxware, which you talk more about Onyxware in a bit. But, like, going to the lab starts a robot fighting minigame that's very similar to Chao Karate. You can see Nito doing, like, super moves in the background with, like, a character cut in.
Yeah.
On a monitor. And there seems to be a sumo element where, like, if you reach the walls of the stage, you lose.
Yeah.
Which is important because the player character cannot fight.
Yep.
Not because they're weak, but because there's no enemy.
Yeah. The robot child who is supposed to be fighting you in the in this little boxing ring is, like, glitched out on the floor, only intermittently showing, like, one frame of them being on the floor in, like, kind of spread out pose, like, ah! And so you just can't interact with them, which is really funny because the player character just ends up having to, you know, ring out twice to end the minigame.
Which gives us the great line from Dr. Nito. You've set a new record. A record for fastest failure.
Yeah. It's so, God, I love it. It's, like you said, it's a really good way of just kind of catching you up to speed of the stakes and the way that the game's going to tell its story.
The music is perfect because it's, like, a mix of the Ace Combat-style D&B, where, like, if you look up PS1 D&B, you will find a ton of collections of background music. Stuff from Ace Combat, Racing Lagoon, The Bouncer.
The Bouncer.
Stuff like that. But also, at first, it's very penis-y.
Yeah,
it's like a boing sound.
The lab that he's in, it has this wonderful, you know, dinky fucking soundtrack of whizzes and vers and beeps and boops.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
I did want to note the fighting bit reminded me of the Kang incident, which this is like Salty Bet deep lore. So Salty Bet is a Twitch stream where people bet on who would win in AI battles in Mugen. With, like, random characters organized by power level. So it's just, like, two characters, which one's gonna win? And nobody's playing them, it's all done by the AI. But there is a time in, like, early when Salty Bet started, where it was Kang from The Simpsons, and it was a mirror match. But one of the Kangs caused a glitch that caused them to disappear, and they couldn't get hit, but there was also no timer. So for like an hour and a half to 2 hours, the stream was just one Kang punching nothing until the creator finally realized what happened and stepped in. So that's what happened here. So
nice reference, Alluvium. Yeah, love to have you on the podcast to talk about Salty Bets.
Yeah. So after that, we get a bit with the compass.
Yes.
Where the father... I think it was just called, like, Pietro.
Yeah. Yeah, Padre Pietro, yeah. Whatever his name is.
Whatever it is. He shows up and says, like, to use your compass, press start button and activate it from your inventory. In a voice that sounded AI generated.
It sounds like it was sourced from the preacher that we see in episode 2, I think.
You remember... One of the early, like, AI voice generation things was, like, using, like, My Little Pony character voice acting.
Yeah,
it was the quality of those.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds backwards.
It's really interesting.
It's Lynchian.
I would be really interested to learn if he used an amount, you know, an old level of AI generation to get that, or if it was, like, sentence mix.
Via Verde is a lot like Mulholland Drive.
Also, when he goes to the inventory to pull out the compass, it is a cross, which is very fun. It has a symbol on the ground when he goes to first-person view that I'm sure is, like, a deep lore, you know, Christian symbol, like a Catholic cross. That isn't extended at the bottom, I believe. But he uses the compass to destroy one of the face monsters that we saw in episodes 1 and 2. It creates like a little patch of nice grass and flowers on the ground and then gives the compass to point towards more things.
The compass rose, compass rosary.
Ah!
The symbol that appears on the ground in first person, after the demon is exorcised, it shows like circles dotting the path outside. which are both representations of the beads on a rosary, but also they're the pathway the player would take in a very, like, it reminds me of Fable's, like, golden path or whatever.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But also, like, a world map path in something like Klonoa. Klonoa 2, at least. It's very nifty in that regard.
Me and the TH Brain Device were walking along a beach, and I looked back and said, "Hey, TH Brain Device, when I was going through my toughest battles, I see there was only one set of footprints." And the TH Brain Device corrupted, and now I'm stuck in a PS1 game.
Yeah, so the player is in the, like, wasteland area that we saw in Via Verde 2. They follow the compass rose to a beach, which has, like, water that's flickering bright pink and blue.
Yeah.
Now, I want to note that the ground is pitch black, looks like magnetic sand. I kind of hate the way it looks.
Yeah.
The water is bright pink. This is the Gmod missing texture land.
I mean, yeah, like, you know, that's not a terrible reading, is it's, yeah, the things just don't have textures and whatnot.
Yeah. Going with the, like, sort of AI generation technology thing, it feels like, so this is sort of the bottommost layer of the quote-unquote game. It feels like these are the worst generations.
Yeah.
Like, it's so dark and staticky and pixely because, like, this is when there was, like, nothing for the technology to do. Like, it was ass. And it made just, like, nothing pictures.
Yeah.
Also, I did want to note that it is black, kind of like onyx. There's a lot of crystals involved in the games within the game.
Yeah.
And crystals as a form of, like, memory has been explored in, like, the bit with Nolt in episode 2, and it will be explored more in this. And I think the name Onyxware is very relevant for being a crystal that is, like, deep black.
Yeah. Onyx, okay. I like that. That's good. That's a good little theme to pick up on.
Yeah. So next we get to, oh my god, I love this part.
The fucking best part.
Yeah. Do you want to do, like, the play-by-play starting with the watchtower?
All right. So we are traveling along the empty abyss, and the player stumbles across a watchtower that seems to be, like, shooting things at us.
Like arrows.
Yeah. He ends up, like, looking up at it and then continuing along, and he, like, turns right, sees the beach, turns left, and we see 2D pixelated, like, little cavemen looking dudes who are mining and carrying bags. And, you know, to read in between the lines a little bit, they seem like RTS workers, which is something that is more or less confirmed when one of them goes through a door that isn't from an RTS, but clearly looks inspired by a collectathon door. It's like a big red cartoony door with a, like, swirl inside.
Yeah, and when the worker goes through it, there's a little wobble.
Yeah, so the player ends up going through the door as well, and we go to this big room, let's say.
It's a circular sort of clearing. It kind of feels like a crater in some regards.
Yeah.
I did want to note as well that the whole time this is going on, there's, like, a clock gear chime sort of thing. Not a chime, like a bell, but, like, a clock tower ambience.
Yeah.
And there's, like, an orrery or a, I guess an orrery or an astrolabe, like, rotating in the distance.
Yeah.
Circling something. And the place that the player goes into is the something.
Yes. So we go into the, you know, the big circle area. There are a whole bunch of different, like, statues or monuments is a very good name. Yeah.
Mythos?
Alex Kisters? Wait, that's not the right one. Mr. Manticore? Anyway.
It starts with an M.
So, like, we have these various constructions. It's usually, like, a visage of a man. There's a visage of, like, a real person, seemingly, in a lot of them. But they're also seemingly directly inspired by various things we've seen before. We saw the angel in one of them, which we have, I believe, seen earlier.
Mm-hmm. The prophetic angel.
Yeah, the prophetic angel.
The 9/11 angel.
We see a number of drawings around one of them, like a 2D looking drawing around one of the statues that looks similar to the drawings, like the actual drawings themselves from the prophetic guy.
Yeah, and the statue looks like, the guy looks like JFK and he's holding a watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever see him directly, but I want to say that one of the guys looks like Nott.
That's kind of the vibe they all give off.
Yeah, like, not seemingly is the same style of, you know, guy. The same style of, like, some sort of realistic visage, like maybe a picture put into the game that ended up getting a 3D model developed around it because of this underbelly.
I do have a theorizing about this, an extrapolation.
Go ahead.
Well, no, continue with the story, because I think explaining the rest of this scene will add to my thing.
Yes. So we, like, not only do we see all these monuments, but we do see these 2D pixelated cavemen dudes continuing to, like, go around with these, like, mining these crystals and going around with these bags, taking them to things. We also see them actually, like, praying at some of them. And then we get one of the more interesting characters of this series.
Yes.
We meet a fucked up wizard looking guy. It's like a green fella.
A witch, like, perhaps.
A witch. Seems very Grunthilda inspired, but like very green, very big nose, big chin, like, you know, hat that's very pointy. And they, I'm just gonna say they are holding a like staff that is super interesting. We'll get to the details for a moment. But notably, like, they see the player and there's an event where, like, it seems like somebody is trying to grab the player with a cursor, like an RTS. And then we look up and see a gigantic version of the witch, who then becomes smaller right in front of the character, and talks directly with the character. We have another TH brain interface thing where we type back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, like I said, it's very clearly inspired by Collectathons and Banjo-Kazooie, so they have a similar voice of like, although it's like a lot of it seems to be like screams.
Yeah,
I love that little detail.
Yeah, so this witch is Morphelius Oraculum.
Such a good name.
Which sounds like Morpheus Oracle, which is my OTP for the Matrix.
Good.
So I love it because, like, the witch does try to select the player character with the, like, click and drag box to select units, and it doesn't work, and that's why the witch shows up and is like, wait a minute, you're not a worker? And later on, the witch even shows them, like, selecting a group of units, and their health bars appear over the workers, which is funny.
Yes.
So my interpretation, hear me out, this is a bit of an extrapolation. So the workers are obviously from an RTS with a, like, historic theme, sort of an Age of Empires. What if the monuments were literally just supposed to be monuments they build in the game? Because a lot of civilization type or, like, historical games put an emphasis on monuments and wonders, but this is, like, a fucked up version. Maybe not specifically these, though one of them is literally just the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
But all the other ones, like the angel statue, could just be, like, other monuments created by the TH brain's generative algorithm.
Yeah, I like that.
But also, my reading is that I kind of wonder if the specific figures of historical people are great people from this historic game.
Yeah.
Like, if that's supposed to be JFK, maybe that is just, like, this game had a JFK guy. You could summon JFK. I don't know. Or it could be a different civ-based thing, but I feel like the fact that they share a model and not just a texture feels too consistent to just be, like, they had a picture of JFK in the database.
Yeah, so, like, to put a finer point on it, earlier I said that, like, we have more of a Watsonian explanation for why there is a large library of stuff, a large library of, like, games and movies and images and whatnot. And seemingly the function is to be a database for the children to create, you know, things in the game or generate things in the game.
Or just as entertainment for the children.
Yeah, also,
they're kids and they're spending more days than a day in the game.
We do see one of those video clips on the actual television when we, like, in episode 2. But I do have to wonder if, like you said, there were also images of historically significant people in this as well. Like, you know, it was a more generalized database. The documents note that a lot of the initial database was public domain stuff, and then a lot of the secondary database, the later database after they got 5 children, was less public domain stuff that wasn't intended for final release. Which is why we have a Dragon Ball Z fighting game in here.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But To go back to the wizard and, like, to go back to the witch and the monuments, I do really like the idea that, like, the confluence of the Age of Empire-style RTS building monuments, like, interacting with the existing things that have been built from the children and from the database to create this sort of, like, ghoulish visage monument. That's a really interesting idea.
I also want to note that with the clock tower sounds, the, like, orrery and mechanics, there are gates into this crater that have, like, what looks like Roman numerals on them.
Yeah.
And one of the statues, again, is holding, like, a pocket watch. And that pocket watch has a very specific function. Keep that in mind. Keep that in your brain.
Yes.
Okay.
So, last thing I want to note about this section is that the witch has a staff of some kind. The staff is really interesting. It is a stick that has, like, a menu on it. Like, a little menu with, like, arrows to the left and right. It looks like a... I would describe it as, like, a roller coaster tycoon menu, you know? Not so looking like that visually, but, like, in terms of function.
So, to me, what it looked like is if you were to open an inventory and then look at an item, it's, like, the window that pops up for that item in particular.
Yeah.
And the arrows to the left and right are, like, go to the next item, go to the previous item.
Okay,
it is holding an eyeball in place. Yeah,
it is
a full-on Neversoft eyeball.
Yeah, it is holding an eyeball that is, like, twitching and looking around, that we get a really good close-up shot of where the eyeball doesn't break contact with the camera, but the camera swivels around.
It's motion-tracked.
Yeah, it's so good. The top of it is, like, this weird, again, like, rockish or crystalline formation that seemingly has the TH Brain branding. TH Brain. TH...
Yeah, TH Brain.
Yeah, TH.
Yeah, so the thing about this is that there have been memory blocks shown with the TH Brain logo, and, like, they were, like, maggots or something eating them. And then also we had the crystal mining done. And again, crystals seem to be a very reoccurring symbol or thing.
Yeah.
But this is just another example. What happens next is really weird.
Yes.
The witch says, like, I'll answer one question about something here. And I think there's, like, an options list of, like, all the statues.
Yeah, we get a couple of names that we recognize. They pop up on subtitles for translation.
The name for the pocket watch statue is 10 o'clock, there's news.
Yes.
Keep that in mind.
That's, yeah.
Keep that in mind.
So we end up clicking on one of them that shows... it's... So, like... We do the thing where we go first person and look up in the sky, and then the witch shows us through the, like, lens of their wand, and we, like, get transported to this, like, CG cutscene.
I don't think it's CG. I think it's live action.
Yeah.
Because it is just, like, it's, like, Third Impact sort of blue monster showing up on Earth. And it looks like it's covered in some sort of rock or crystal, perhaps.
Yeah.
But then, like, cut to a fucking kaiju costume.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's unsure. The one question I have is basically, it is unsure if this is supposed to be another piece of media in the database, or if this is supposed to be, like, a prophetic vision of something that's going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
it looks to me like an intro cutscene for a video game.
Yeah. Like, that's what I assume it is, too, is, like, it's some kind of, like, cutscene or, like, a movie. But the implication, then, of how that directly ties with the monument and, like, the things that the monument interacts with is really interesting.
Yeah, and it ties in with the ongoing themes, like you said, of, like, prophecy and destruction and bombs.
Yeah. So, like, we get that vision, and then the witch is like, all right, I've shown you enough. Get out of here.
And they kick the player out through the back door.
We see a green door that we can't open again, and so we just kind of continue on.
But player tries walking into the water and gets shot.
Yeah.
Which causes the game over menu.
Well, first after we go away from the back door, I believe go into another small thing. It looks like an outpost. There's a cage that has one of the angel things that was devoured in episode one, I believe.
There is a collapsed robot on the ground near the angel, I believe.
Yeah, but that's when we then, like, walk towards the ocean to see what happens and get shocked and have to go.
So, I don't know if you had seen the scene in the first episode with this game over screen, but it mentions turn on the system on March 22nd.
Well,
cut to March 22nd.
This is so good. Okay, so the player walks in on the town, but the town is vastly different. It is like cracked, like a big earthquake happened, or like an anime earthquake rather, with a lot of, you know, discrete little islands. The player cannot progress by like walking through. We like do that inspect thing that we do with the dev tool, but notably a cutscene occurs, and the cutscene shows the fox, the head of the town, the mayor. It shows Dr. Nito, and it shows the like shopkeep character.
Yeah.
And they are doing this little cult ritual, let's say,
mm-hmm.
where like the fox is like, what is the Dr. Nito, brother Dr. Nito, what is the point of progress? And Dr. Nito is like, the point of progress is to, you know, ensure the goodness of all. He's, you know, Mr. Shopkeep, what's the point of liberty? And it's like, to blah, blah, blah. And then we have a really fun little thing where the both of them, the shopkeep and the doctor, ask the leader, what is the point of leadership? But they do it, but like the way it's shown that they're both asking at the same time is by rapidly flickering the text boxes and the player portraits. Lovely little detail.
Yeah.
And the leader's like, you know, the point of leadership is to bring forward a new prosperous time. Well, the cult ritual is put on because a gigantic bull-ish figure, I don't know if this is the same figure that we like saw a little bit of in episode 2.
I think it is.
I want to say it is. If I'm wrong, then I apologize to all women everywhere. But like we see the big bronze, like bronze-headed, bronze-calf-headed, like multi-armed figure. It has the, like you said, the orrery sort of spinning around its base. And the leader is like, you know, great mighty one, we bring you this offering. And they pull over the Argentinian flag to show a robot.
So I want to mention real quick, by the way, that they summon this, like, calf thing, and there's another of those eyeballs.
Yeah!
And the eyeball is just, like, on an altar, and it cuts to a perspective from the eyeball, and then, like, the perspective sort of warps.
Yeah, because the shopkeep comes up with, like, a golden calf. And so he shows the golden calf to the eyeball, and then the perspective warps, and then we get the bronze, you know, the big bronze god. Oh, yeah. Wow, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it warps in a way very similar to what happened when the witch showed the blue statue in the cutscene to the player.
Yeah. Oh, man. So we get the bronze god, and the fox is like, you know, I know that this is this robot is not necessarily what you want.
It's like he's like, the other ones haven't been good, but this one is better.
Yes.
And with time they can be better than the five.
Yes, that's it. The robot gets like rejected basically. It gets like dissolved into one of the pilars.
Mm-hmm.
And
pilars.
I believe it's literally
I think it's just pillar.
Well, it's probably just pillar. No, you know what it is? It's spelled P-I-L-A-R, probably in Spanish. And so I saw that and was like, oh, it's a pilar.
We must construct additional pilars. I do want to just, before you do thing, I just want to say the implication is that Dr. Nito is creating robots so that they don't have to sacrifice human children.
Yes, yes.
Also, there is a thing of, like, dead woman in a dumpster.
Yeah! Oh, God, that's
says,
right!
Like, the woman you have prepared haven't succeeded.
Haven't sufficed.
Yeah.
Like
they tried having, they tried making... babies.
Yeah, like making breeding stock, basically,
yeah.
Which is another horrific fucking angle to it that is, like, wonderful for a horror series and terrible.
Yeah, and the procedure they follow to, like, at the start, where they talk about, like, what is freedom and all that, is the motto that is written on the, like, carpenter squares that led to the underworld.
Yeah, the like liberty fraternity leadership or
liberty fraternity
says.
Equality, I think.
Yeah.
which is the French Revolutionary motto.
Yes. So the robot child gets rejected, and Dr. Nito is the one who argues. He's like, "Whoa, you rejected this one? You know, surely if you just give us more time, I know the other ones have been bad, but, you know, if you just give us more time, I'm sure this will be even better." And then he gets stabbed by a chain, and, like, he gets pulled into the god. We get the best fucking scene in the entire thing. It's so good. It's so gruesome. I'm sure that there was already, a bit of a content warning at the beginning, but content warning again, because he gets, like, pulled in and, like, strapped in, you know, like, arms up, legs up. And so a series of events happens. His mouth is, like, just slowly, like, dissolved away, just, like, wiped away, like you've deleted the texture. The inside of the orrery begins to spin. We get music swelling. And the doctor begins to burn alive, and we hear muffled screams until his mouth burns open, at which point the music swells even louder, and, like, instead of strictly hearing him scream, like, we get the singer going, like, "Oh!"
Yeah.
It begins to rain blood upon everyone, and at the end of the process, the doctor is a charred husk, still alive. Like, we hear him, like, panting and, like, but it just gets unceremoniously dropped on, like, the fountain, the centerpiece of the town, with him, you know, strapped up. And the god says stuff. It's in a script that I don't know if it is, like, just, you know, a real old script or if it is a fake language for the series. But the god talks to, you know, the town folk very, very briefly, and I don't know, like, we don't have the translations on hand directly. I really hope somebody in the community has translated it. I would love to, you know, love to know.
It's, like, vaguely Sanskrit inspired.
Yeah, it's super cool. But, like, the cutscene ends eventually, and the player is dispensed out into a more normal town. It's not, like, cracked and earthquaked. But, like I said, instead of the centerpiece of the town, instead of the statue of the fox mayor, we have Dr. Nito, the charred husk, still gasping for breath.
There's kanji written on it. Please tell me what it is.
Yeah, I should get back on the Discord for Vive Air Day to see if people have solved this.
Yeah.
It's so good.
A lot of this is just our, like, viewing and our interpretation. We haven't really done any cross-referencing.
Yes, yeah, like...
So we don't have to cite any sources.
Yep. And we're not going to.
Fuck you, Harris. Just kidding. Come on and talk about fucking, I don't know. Donkey Kong 64.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to go through the next points really quickly. But first, this is a bronze bowl.
Yes, bronze bowl. Excellent.
Not 100% bronze bowl, but the burning part definitely is. And it's a bronze bowl, golden calf, you know, cow as a form of idolatry here.
Yeah, yeah.
Is a reoccurring theme, a reoccurring symbol in this case. The next few things that happens, we've just had a long recording here. But now that he's dead, time for Pac-Man.
Pac-Man!
Oh, wait, no, hold on. First, after this cutscene with Dr. Nito, the clock strikes 10.
Yes, yeah.
The watch, the JFK watch. This episode of JFK Watch.
Yeah, we are one more hour to midnight with this failure sacrifice, seemingly.
Yeah, is the failure counting up? Is the death counting up? But it's 10 o'clock, there's news, and the news is Pac-Man.
Yeah.
It shows a game called Superplex, which is a great name that definitely fits a
PS1 era.
A PS1 era Pac-Man type gubble-looking-ass, yeah. Cube-looking-ass. It reminds me of the internal plexus, just the word plex. But I love it because it feels like Frogger PS1.
Yeah.
If that was done to Pac-Man. Because, like, Frogger PS1 was like, here's regular Frogger. All right, we've extended Frogger a bit. Don't mind the edges. I know it plays kind of awkward. But, like, this is like if you were to take Pac-Man and keep the maze and the dot eating, but then, like, add traps and saw blades and lasers. Very, very fitting, I think. Very believable, which is sort of how a lot of the games feel. Then we get to Hexacom, which is an Eidos game.
Yeah.
Eidos? The, you know, the Deus Ex dudes.
Yeah.
it's really funny because, like, it just starts with the intro for Eidos and then it skips it. And then there's an intro cutscene and it skips it. The game sort of plays like Metal Gear Solid. There is a full-on, like, plot synopsis intro that is in English and it flashes for a moment during the loading screen. It also mentions that, like, there is this secret government organization or, like, rogue military that's doing crystal mining. So that's another game where crystal mining is a thing. And it could be that the crystals that the workers were mining were specifically from Hexacom, whereas the workers were from some separate game.
Yeah.
I do also wonder if the workers are related to that, like, Golden Angel guy? If that was a ActRaiser-style god game?
Yeah.
Just other sort of speculation. But the player character for Hexacom is a Shoot Andy.
Yeah, he's the main character from fucking Winback. It's,
yeah,
you know, it's generic white man.
It's a third-person shooter that has a first-person scope. Goes through, like, this military complex, very Shadow Moses-inspired.
However, the military complex is glitching the fuck out.
Yes.
There's a really fun thing where one of the enemies is, like, stuttering up and down, like, halfway in the ground and standing normally, and the other one is, like, clearly mid-animation trying to run forward, but it gets, like, all twisted and, like, gedonned, you know, halfway through. Yeah,
it is very gedon.
Yeah.
That's a great... I was going to say it's just a corruption. Like a bignot while you play corrupt. But, like, it is very gedon, which is fitting because the like, famous gedon video was GoldenEye.
Yeah.
Cartridge tilting, which is a form of corruption. So it's very similar to that. There's also a door that's flickering up and down.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
We have a very interesting thing here where we go through the door and the footage hard cuts, except, like, the footage hard cuts, but it seems like it's a single animation, basically. Like, we have gone not just from one scene, you know, one scene to a new scene, but, like, this was part of one contiguous scene, except we are less a little bit of health after that cut, too,
yeah.
Which is really interesting. Don't know the implications of that. We're just going to move on.
And after even more of the complex starts glitching out, including more of the terrain itself, the player character falls through the floor.
And then slides down a bit of an incline.
Falls past what looks like the area Nolt was in with, like, data blocks and snow. And ends up in the underworld area.
But it's a very interesting section of the underworld area. Because in exploring it, we end up finding a number of the robots.
Yeah.
Like,
so,
fairly intact number of the robots.
It's great. The character first sees one robot kind of scrapped apart, as well as literal Crash Bandicoot TNT boxes.
Yeah, it peppers in a couple of real game things, which is, again, like, excellent. That's great, you know, establishment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also very funny.
And then turns around to see Midas written in, like, an English script made to look like Greek in a little Greek ruin sort of place. And inside is so many robots.
Yeah. It's a whole bunch of robots. Some of them are, like, holding, you know, spears and acting like guards. There's a, like, a dog creature that looks like a Nightmare Creatures kind of enemy that is, like, in a cage when we walk in, I think.
Reminds me of Bloodborne.
Yeah. Nightmare Creatures is, like, basically PS1 Bloodborne before PS1 Bloodborne was a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we then walk forward and begin to see, we're not in the gates of the Midas area yet, but we see a fucked up face with another eye in the middle of
it. A giant head with an eye in its mouth.
Yeah. The face is, like, half melted, but the eye is kind of doing the same thing that the other eyes have been doing.
Jittering.
Yeah, jittering around and stuff.
Me when I have too much caffeine.
And the robots seem to be protecting it.
And in the air is that suspended robot tied up in chains.
Yeah. And so what's really funny is when we're outside Midas, the player zooms in by using the gun, which is a very natural thing to do as a player, of course.
Especially in, like, an immersive sim type game.
Yeah. I feel like I have to call you out and say it is not an immersive. That's not
it's,
what an immersive
sim is. It's made by Eidos.
It is made by Eidos.
What do you want me to say?
An immersive sim.
We don't know if it's not an immersive sim.
It is
sim.
A third-person shooter in the style of Winback and possibly Metal Gear Solid.
I feel like Metal Gear Solid is close enough.
Metal Gear Solid is... They're, okay, look, I watched too much Civi 11. Look, I know what an MSIM...
We don't even know what the game plays like. We just know there's a guy who shoots.
Alluvium, get on here and solve the argument for us. So, after looking through the scope, the player walks in and sees the scene and then zooms in through the scope again and then begins taking damage. Notably, the player also took a lot of fall damage as well, so they were very low health coming into this. But they begin taking damage and they put down their gun and the robots are attacking them and the dog has been freed to also attack him.
Yeah.
And so the player dies, the mission restarts, but when we get back to the mission area, it has now become so corrupted that the player just immediately falls, and we go through somewhat similar but obviously very different locales and end up at the floor, which is King Kai's place.
It's fucking King Kai's palace.
It's so...
Goku, we have to save the world from the bronze calf. I just gotta level up my power level by running down this hill for a thousand years. We don't have enough time, Goku.
I love, too, that I'm fairly certain it's specifically King Kai's palace from, like, one of the shittiest DBZ fighters. Like, one of the most notably bad ones.
Oh, you mean Dragon Ball FighterZ?
Yes. like, it's, yeah, and the player immediately dies, and then it gets corrupted because of the fall damage. The corruption may not have been the fall damage, it might have been just the regular corruption.
Yeah.
Either way, yeah, like, it's, again, such a cool, fuck, motherfucker just made an entire other video game to help the narrative and then corrupted it forever.
A few notes: when the player starts playing this game, the Hexacom, it mentions like no memory card inserted, use TH brain memory interface, implying they can store the memory for the video game in your brain,
which is so fucked.
And also it mentions like TH brain device corrupted, continue.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they're using Jansung's TH brain device to connect to the game this way.
Oh yeah. Because
presumably after confirmed death, they could disconnect him.
Oh my god.
I mean, they don't make any notes about having a corpse near all the other still connected kids.
That's a really good point.
I also love that this is the second shooter that has been introduced. There was the like survival horror shooter in the second episode, but they feel so different from each other. Like the survival horror one has more like fixed camera angles. It has like a more Japanese storyline, whereas since this one was made by American developer or Canadian? North American developers, it's in English. I think that aspect is so cool that two games where like shooting is the main function have such different aesthetics about them and like conventions. I want to recommend Super Eyepatch Wolf's videos on games you can't play or like games that aren't games.
Yeah.
And fictional games, I guess, but it's a video he touches on Valle Verde for a bit, and I don't 100% agree with his reading, but that's the fun of that type of thing, is that you can come to your own conclusions. And he talks a bit about how, like, a big part of what makes fake video games so compelling is that because they use these, like, tropes that we are so familiar with, it is possible to imagine what the game would play like, thus becoming a sort of interactive experience in its own right.
Yeah.
How, like, even an image of a fake UI can imply things like controls, usage, genre, like, tone, atmosphere, story. And those implications are very fun to mess with in your head and be like, well, maybe this means that. And that's a lot of what we're doing when we discuss Valle Verde, not just in terms of Valle Verde's story, but the context that the games exist in.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that the witch character, we've been saying that they're inspired by collectathons.
But, like, we don't know the source game.
Yeah, there's no, like, collectibles shown. There's no, like, jiggies or stars. There is no, like, box art, whereas there is box art for Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, yeah, there is just a basically Dragon Ball Z cover, which is so good.
But the things like the voice lines and the just model and the animations are also attached to these like mechanical genre conventions that it allows us to extrapolate, and that sort of adds an extra layer of depth and meaning. Like, to me, it's interesting that the survival horror game was used and they get attacked by these monsters, Whereas the, like, infiltration game actually infiltrates a, like, base of operations.
Yeah.
Like, the game language these characters exist in is still being enacted, even in situations outside of that game.
That's a really good point. I wonder how Pac-Man's gonna tie into all of this. Pac-Man eats a power pellet and then eats the bronze bowl, and that's the ending.
Yeah. So, after that whole thing, we get one more very important scene.
Yes.
At the village, where there is a huge crowd around the church, the Catholic church that has appeared since the first episode, and there's like a bubble shield around the church with pretty much all the townsfolk, especially Mayor Foxo, on the outside of. And Foxo wants us to get in there and plant this little thing inside.
Also should note that in this scene, the biblically accurate angel from earlier in the series is like right outside the church. Like, he's just in the sky around it.
Yeah.
Which is really fun.
Yeah, so Foxo hands the player one of those carpenter squares and is like, hey, you want to make some extra coinage? Go put this in there. But the player goes and is met by the father as well as, like, a little cat kid. Unsure if she is related to the, like, so Matthias didn't have a human body.
Matthias was the little cat child, or at least was in was the form that, of one of them.
Okay.
I want to say...
I feel like the child depicted behind the father in this was different. I was wondering if it's supposed to be Chloe?
Ah.
Who is the only girl amongst the players?
Yeah, I'm curious about that. I don't have them side by side, so I don't know if it was Matthias, but I know that Matthias did show up as, like, a little cat boy, I believe.
Yeah. So, the father says something to the player, and then the player is sort of sent inside the church. The player opens their inventory, uses the carpenter square, and what appears are the pillars.
Yeah, yeah. The area around them gets very dark, and we get a little scene where we see in the light, I think, a figure who quotes a I have to assume a real recording from somebody.
Yeah, it's like a news recording.
Yeah, it's like a father or somebody associated with the church who in Spanish is saying, like, you know, when I heard the news, I couldn't believe it. I rushed out to work, didn't think the day would be any different, but then I heard it.
So I think it was a cardinal.
Yeah,
voting
yeah.
at the Vatican.
That would be my assumption, yeah.
They tell the real story of Pope John Paul I.
Yes, we get, like, after the cardinal or whoever it was tells their side, we get a news report that is in English and is like, the world is shocked today. As John Paul I, a well-beloved pope, was recently pronounced dead, the shock is amplified by his confirmation as pope. Only 33 days earlier.
You gotta do it in more of a transatlantic accent.
Oh yeah, of course. Hey, the Pope died!
That's not... What is this? Cypher from Valorant, what are you doing here?
Hey, I just wanted to tell you, but the Pope died. I was in the church. You know the quaint Pope? The one you're currently thinking of? He died.
Damn.
Yeah, it's quite a tragedy. Anyway, apparently the new Pope is gonna be... Lindsay Pope, I think.
That's pretty progressive for a Pope.
Yeah, it's really, really proud of the Catholic Church. That's why I'm here at the most progressive Catholic Church, which of course you also are currently at.
I forgot we were in a church. That's how invested I was into this podcast.
Yeah, Vi Verde really does things to you. Anyway, bye Cypher from Valorant. Okay, spaghetti!
So, during this whole thing, the roof caves in. There is still, like, an angel statue in the back, but otherwise it is very dark, like you said. But, like, shadowy figures start to appear from the pillars and, like, walk around.
Yeah, it's shadowy figures of the father.
Yeah.
Father Pietro. Also, I did remember it is Pietro because it's Peter.
Yeah. That part's really neat. Just, it's so weird and interesting. The whole shadowy figures bit, they, like, yeah. More and more of them spawn until they create, like, a fence.
Yeah, yeah. It repeats the 33 days earlier, and every time it does, more of them spawn until, like you said, it's just a mass of models. And then we get a flash, I believe, a flash of white, I want to say.
Yeah.
And the player exits the church to a really interesting scene, because all of these, like charred fathers are now working, seemingly under, like, the direction of the mayor, and it's really interesting what they're doing, because, like, it seems like they are basically creating more idols. Notably, there is a picture of Piss Christ.
Okay, please explain Piss Christ for the listeners.
Okay, so, Piss Christ, aka Immersion, parentheses, Piss Christ, parentheses, is a photograph from 1987 by the American artist and photographer Andres Serrano. It's so cool that I knew that right off the top of my head. It depicts a plastic crucifix that has, like, notably, you can at the very least make out it's clearly a crucifix with Jesus, immersed in a tank of urine. It is a very notable picture because it caused a lot of fucking controversy. A lot of, a lot of Catholics and a lot of people who were otherwise Christian did not like it. There was a very big stir caused. It's kind of like, it's brought up in examples similarly to, like, Dadaism, sort of, or, like, other examples of very offensive art as, like, really big controversial pieces. Who's Afraid of Red, Yellow, and Blue is another good example. Like, it's one of the more notable pieces of extremely transgressive art that caused a big reaction. And, of course, it's really interesting to see it here alongside a table that has the golden calf figure and seemingly, like, I don't know if it's painted or if it's just, like, on a canvas near one of the charred fathers, but, like, the implication is that, you know, the fathers themselves had something to do with the fact that it's here now. There, we also see a Washington monument.
I just wanted to say, Piss Christ, not to be confused with Milk Pope. Again, I am very excited for October.
God damn it.
It's a little hint. A little teaser.
A little teaser. Yeah, you're getting more than just emoji teasers this time. So, we also see a Washington monument in the background with one of the carpenter angles that's, like, floating above it. I personally likened this as a, like, Tower of Babel style, like, reference. I wouldn't die on that hill. I wouldn't die on that cross.
I think it's just the Washington Monument.
Yeah, it
very
well
could
just.
Which has its own sort of relevancy.
Yeah.
It is surrounded by scaffolding towards the base that looks much larger than the Washington Monument should be and gives it a very phallic sort of form.
Yes, yes.
As if the Washington Monument needed to be more phallic.
Yeah. We see the mayor, of course, overseeing all these things. And then the player walks up to the father, mm-hmm. the non-churred one. And he is dressed in Pope vestments.
Yeah. He's the Pope.
He's the Pope. I believe, like you said, one of the children or one of the little avatars of the children is, like, behind him. And they are also, like, they are in an area that is, like, hard blocked off by a bunch of barricades from earlier, but they are in, like, the dome, in the, you know, the magic holy whatever. The player talks to the father, and the father, like, gives words of assurances, basically, of, like, the forces of evil cannot comprehend the humbleness of a simple carpenter, something to that effect. And we get the final words, and then the episode ends.
Maybe it wasn't that the character was met by the father outside of the church at the start of the previous scene.
Maybe it was that they showed up the second half.
Maybe I mixed it up. I wanted to note, by the way, that at the time that the game would have happened, there was one pope, Pope John Paul II, who had succeeded John Paul I after he had died 33 days into his papacy.
Yep.
So this could imply that the Father Pietro is the John Paul II in this scenario. As yeah. That would have been the current pope at the time of the game's development.
That makes a lot of sense, and I also do want to sprinkle in, as a Catholic, as an ex-Catholic, who cares more about Catholicism now that I don't care, now that I'm not part of the church, like most Catholics, John Paul II is notably, like, one of the most beloved popes, just kind of period. Like, even Francis, who is, in my opinion, the best pope we've had, like, can't really compare to just the amount of, you know, the amount of just general love for JP2. So I find that really interesting and wonder if that is going to be relevant. Wonder if the specifics of John Paul II are going to be relevant to the series as well.
Did you mention that there's a tunnel to the underworld now in the town? And that some of the Shadow Fathers are, like, bringing stuff out of it?
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so the town also has a tunnel to the underworld, and the Shadow Fathers are bringing stuff out of it. There is a sign above the tunnel written in that, like, language the bronze calf spoke.
Yes.
The, like, not cuneiform. I'm going to bet, I don't know how much I would bet, I'm not a betting person, but I'm going to bet that says, abandon all hope, ye who enter. That's just the type of thing this is. We haven't had enough Dante in this.
Yeah.
We need Dante Alighieri, who is a big lore master for, you know, Christianity.
Hey, Dante, if you want to be on the podcast and talk about...
Dante's Inferno for the PS3.
Yep. Okay, so we have more or less wrapped up the play-by-play. Things I just want to say about this series... One, go watch it.
Please. Two,
I love, like, the things that I love about this series are, A, it is deep, deep lore to a lot of real world things. Like,
it feels disingenuous to say deep lore in that sense.
Yeah.
I could say, like, maybe Catholicism has deep lore.
I mean very specifically deep lore in terms of Catholicism, not in terms of, like, Hiroshima.
Yeah, I think when it comes to, like, real, like, history.
Yeah, not like in terms of the real life political unrest, but in terms of, like, it makes a lot of the references you would expect. It also just makes a lot of references that you really, like, that are clearly, like, somebody who cares more than just sort of, you know, the general pop culture knowledge of Catholic mythology. This isn't, you know, the eating of the fruit of the Garden of Eden is one of the best scenes in the series, in my opinion. Just because, like, it's well done in a way that, like, eating the fruit of the Garden of Eden isn't usually, is how I would put it.
So, I have a lot to say on this. I think we are seeing a very clear theme of idolatry.
Yes.
We have the obvious bronze calf. There is Midas, King Midas.
Yep, yep.
You know, touch these things, turn to gold. King Midas is a tale often told about, like, obsession and greed. But I think the greed in this case is also a form of idolatry. A pretty common reading is that Midas essentially worshipped gold, and that the whole curse to turn everything he touched to gold is itself sort of a curse of, you know, you worship this so much that you will now be punished.
Yeah.
I think that is an intentional look, especially in terms of the use of gold and yellow, because the calf has a sort of golden look. There's Piss Christ,
yep,
which is a golden idol in a way. And then the way that sort of statues and monuments are presented feels very idolatrized. I feel like I want to bring up monument mythos, but I don't. In monument mythos, statues were used to cover up horrors in a way that comments on nationalism.
Yes.
In this case, I think it has a similar perspective of monuments and idols taking, or monuments taking the form of idols as people look to them and worship their country, or worship, you know, the artists behind them.
Yeah.
Or the construction of them versus other things. Not necessarily, like, it's not that you have to worship God. I don't want it to get out there that that's what I'm preaching, but, like,
if there's one thing, we're currently in a church. If there's one thing we love here, it's that God is real, he loves you, and go to your local whatever denomination church you have.
So, like, but that being said, you could argue that people who look at something like the Statue of Liberty and go, like, oh yeah, America, are doing a form of worship.
Yeah.
And then the monuments also kind of work with Civ. In a way, this is also a game that aligns itself with Civ in Civ's view of history, because I feel like there is a common thread of not just monuments, but great people.
Yeah.
That a lot of very specific people have been referenced. And the idea of cataloging all these different works is like cataloging great works. It is a view of history not as people, as like groups of people and cultures, but as individuals.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, the people, the characters in the game, like Foxo, preach, like, equality and togetherness. And a lot of the political aspects of the story relate to the people,
yeah,
revolution, and people versus the government. But that is kind of contrary to the story that is told in a lot of video games based around civilizations and history.
Yeah.
And even then, there is a comment that, you know, games kind of naturally lead towards great person stories because there is a single player to it, and it's hard to tell a single player story that doesn't revolve around a great person in some regard.
Yeah.
There is an aspect of defying creators in that generative AI is essentially allowing the characters within the video games to re-sculpt the video games, whether in the form of a deity like the Bronze Calf that seems to have taken over Foxo and Via Verde the game, but also like the Witch or Aculum or whatever is sort of creating their own workshop, their own like hideout area,
yeah,
using the staff and all these other abilities. It is in a way a, like, if you view the creators of the video games as the gods of this world, they are working against their god.
Yeah.
And I think there's a really interesting conflict there, because I feel like it is apt to be like, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. That could lead to bad things. At what point have they gone past, like, sentience?
Yeah.
I think it is, like, the ethical question of unplugging the kids from the video game also has this aspect of, like, Have they actually developed artificial intelligence? And again, relating to current day generative AI, it's like, we don't have actual artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
But it is complicated to think about, like, you know, what if there was an artificial intelligence that could then generate these things super fast, but also had such deep-seated views on, like, religion and, like, who they worship?
Yeah.
It's an interesting culmination of not just history and religion, but also modern day technology that is very pressing. The themes of computers running amok and like AI doing inscrutable things, they aren't exactly new, but the fact that the game in Via Verde are using the materials of the game in the things in the database feels like a very targeted thing towards generative AI.
Yeah. Yeah, like, one of the things that I love about this series is that it feels as though, kind of constantly, the threads always come back to the children who are trapped. Like, it feels like I've said earlier, it feels like the world itself has been warped and kind of created based off of all of the children who are in it and has all these pieces of their culture because it's what they knew. And so, like you said, the fact that it has this sort of political aspect, this, like, rebellious aspect of, you know, creations rebelling against their god, the fact that it has, like, using old data to create new things. I love the point of the monuments themselves are sort of an analog for the nationalism of the idolatry of nationalism. Because I feel like that's very, like, if there is a time in your life where you are going to be, you know, 100% nationalist and look up at whatever your closest monument is with a swelling pride, it is going to be when you are a small child and you don't really know a whole lot about where you live, but know that you should be proud of it. And so it feels like, you know, the monument section is built off of these memories and is directly based off of these things because the children themselves are what dictates the world. Like, the world is currently shaping itself because of these experiences. Also, just the fact that, like, video game mechanics are being used in a way that really directly influences all of that. The fact that it's RTS, you know, it's RTS units that are building the monuments. The fact that, like, it is a sort of, like, assuming it's like a collectathon. The fact it's like a Gruntilda-esque witch that is being the one at the head constructing all these monuments. The fact that, like, the leader, the mayor of an Animal Crossing town who has a specific fetish for it, basically, who has a lot of delusions of grandeur, is the one that is, like, the head of also this cult, and is the one that, like, defiled the church in the town.
Yeah.
And is now leading all these charred fathers.
We didn't even mention that at the very end of the FBI report, it mentions that, Dr. Kunimochi was, like, seeing a cult.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Just tacked onto the bottom of the report, like, here's a fun little detail. Think about that. But yeah, it all ties together in a really cool way. And I just want to mention something. So Hexacom, it mentions that the name of the complex in the game is the Hexagon. This game, or this series does remind me of The Hex, the Daniel Mullins game.
Yeah!
I wonder if Alluvium was inspired at all by the Mullins verse.
Yeah. Oh, would not even be surprised. I would.
Because, games turning against their creators is also a very central reoccurring motif in the Mullins verse.
Yeah. So you brought up Monument Mythos, and unfortunately, I am going to say the word Pets Cop.
Well, okay, I don't think that's unfortunate. We like it, we did episodes on it, it's a PS1 digital horror thing.
Yeah, it's like, I don't say that because it's a bad series, but more like, you know, it feels like the kind of thing where if I were to say, this feels like Pets Cop, it's like saying this feels like Undertale
this
about
feels like an immersive sim.
Yeah, this feels like... like, it feels like, you know, guy who has only seen one analog horror series, but I really do want to make the case that, like, if you are somebody who's like, there'll never be another Pets Cop, get in on the ground floor. This is already a series that is sort of, like, doing a lot of the themes that Pets Cop did, using the gameplay mechanics to tell the story in similar ways to how Pets Cop ended up doing it. That has, like, deeper lore to it and deeper interpersonal drama to it. Maybe less interpersonal drama than Pets Cop did specifically, since it is more of a, like, delving into this, trying to save a couple of kids rather than being about a lot of the interpersonal drama. There's mechanics at play here. Point being, it all kind of builds toward a very similar series. It all builds towards similar themes, towards similar skill sets. If you liked the whole fact that you could almost tell how Pets Cop works by watching the series, you'll love how you can, like, almost tell how a lot of the games work by watching Via Verde.
Here's my question. How long until we get some Hieronymus Bosch references?
Yeah, give us the fucked up guys.
Give us the fucked up guys.
Yeah, Via Verde, good. Watch it.
Yeah, watch it, and keep in touch with us as we do other stuff. But for now, thank you for listening. You can find us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing, let us know what topics you'd want to see us cover next, or just things you think we might like. You can also find us on Twitter at NetSurferPro and on Blue Sky at NetSurferPro.bsky.social to contact us and also follow us for those emoji teasers as listed before.
Hell yeah.
As well as if we have any future delays as we have recently, we will obviously post on there for updates. You can also follow me at Twackaroo on Twitter and twack.beastguy.social, or on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack, TWAK for all of those. On my socials, I've been posting a lot of pinball scores and stuff, but on the stream, I haven't been able to stream recently due to busyness and stuff, but I'm trying to get back to streaming so that I can do some cool streams coming up in the future.
As for myself, you can find me on Twitter, on TikTok, and on Blue Sky at Galen Wilson. That's at GALENWLS0N. BSky.social for Blue Sky, of course. I post my hot takes and videos talking about my opinions on things. I'd recommend following my TikTok first. I've honestly been considering deleting Twitter. Fuck Twitter. But
delete Twitter, lawyer up, hit the gym. Or no, sorry, it's hit the lawyer, gym up, and delete Twitter. No, delete the lawyer, Twitter up, gym hit.
You can also find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, and you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. I will hopefully have videos out soon. I've actually been doing a lot of scripting, so fingers crossed. But until then...
Hey, what's this, like, red button that fell out of your pocket? Should I press this? I mean, it's big and red.
It is a big red button, but I don't know what it does. Like, I don't know how this got in my pocket. Maybe the father slipped it in here.
You weren't trying to, like, steal this, were you?
No, I was trying to steal so much other stuff. I wasn't paying attention to any red buttons.
Okay, cool. Should I press it?
I'm gonna press it.
Okay.